Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Hamish Johnston. This week marks the 30th anniversary of the Hubble Space Telescope, which has captured innumerable and often iconic images of the universe. Coming up later, we're in conversation with the astronomy writer Keith Cooper, who talks about some of his Hubble highlights from the past three decades. But first, an important clue about why there is so much more matter than antimatter in the visible universe has been found by physicists working on the T2K experiment in Japan. The team measured the rate at which muon neutrinos transform into electron neutrinos as they stream through nearly 300 kilometers of solid rock. Then they made the same measurement on muon antineutrinos, which transform into electron antineutrinos. The rates they measured were significantly different, and this matter-antimatter symmetry violation could help explain why we appear to live in a universe dominated by matter. Recently, I spoke to the particle physicist Silvia Pascoli, who explained what this measurement could mean for our understanding of the universe. I'm joined down the line by Silvia Pascoli, who is professor in the Institute for Particle Physics Phenomenology at Durham University in the UK. Hi, Silvia.
Hello, Amish.
So, Silvia, why is it important to measure matter-antimatter symmetry violation in neutrino oscillations?
So, there are two main reasons. The first one that the violation of the matter-antimatter parity symmetry is very puzzling to theoretical physicists. We do not understand why this is the case. We would expect naively that this behavior of a particle and an antiparticle in a mirror world were the same. But this is not the case. This was first discovered in 1964 in the quark sector. We don't understand the reason, and we want first to see if this is true also in the lepton sector. Leptons are electrons, muon, taus, and neutrinos. So we do not know yet if this symmetry is violated in the leptons as it is in the quark sector, and this is what T2K is giving us information on.
And this is very important when it comes to possibly understanding why there's more matter than antimatter in the universe, is that right?
Yes, this is the second reason why I think this is really a crucial question in particle physics, one of the most fundamental questions we have to address. So we know that in the universe, there's more matter than antimatter. Actually, there's not nearly any antimatter at all. If there is a small asymmetry in the amount of matter and antimatter very early on in the universe, then what happened is that most of the matter and antimatter annihilated each other, but the little bit of extra matter couldn't find the corresponding antimatter and remained as a relic. Now, this relic is extremely important. It's what makes stars, galaxies, planets, us. We are made of matter, not antimatter. So the origin of this matter-antimatter imbalance in the early universe is not known and is one of the most fundamental questions in physics. Importantly, in the 60s, Sakharov identified the conditions which are required to generate this asymmetry spontaneously in the early universe. And one of these conditions, there are three key ones, one of them is the violation of the CP symmetry. Now, we know that the CP violation in the standard model, that one in the quark sector, is not enough to explain the amount of baryon asymmetry we observe. And so we need to find other explanations. And there is a very favored way to explain the origin of this baryon asymmetry, which is leptogenesis. And leptogenesis requires leptonic CP violation. So if T2K results are confirmed and there is a discovery of leptonic CP violation, we would be a little bit closer to understand the origin of the baryon asymmetry of the universe. We'll never be able to test it directly, but at least we will have some important clues.
And were you surprised by the large amount of CP violation that has been suggested by the T2K results?
Not really. I mean, as a neutrino physicist, I'm used to surprises given to us by neutrinos. Neutrinos are the only fermions in the standard model which are only left-handed. They have masses, and this was a great surprise when this was discovered in 1998. And now we know that the mixing angles are very different to the quark sector. So, no, indeed, when I deal with neutrinos, I try to keep an open mind. There is no reason why the violation of the CP symmetries, if it is there, should be a small quantity. So, for me, is a not unexpected result.
And what further measurements will be needed to confirm the T2K results?
So T2K has seen strong hints of a different behavior of neutrinos and antineutrinos for this violation of the CP symmetry, but it's not yet a discovery. So if we really want to be sure that these hints are true and that the CP symmetry is violated, then we need a more powerful experiment. And this is what very excitingly is going to happen in this decade. There are two experiments which are being under construction. One is T2 Hyper-K. This is an experiment in Japan with a bigger detector. It's a gigantic pool of water which will look for neutrinos and antineutrinos. And excitingly, this has been approved last February and is going to start construction soon. And in the US, there is the DUNE project, also with a strong European component. This will be based at Sanford Lab. And the beam will be at Fermilab, and it's another very kind of large project which uses a different technology. So the two experiments together are complementary. And these two experiments, if the value of this CP violating parameter that T2K has hints for remain where they are, then these experiments should be able to give us a definite proof, a discovery.
So would that be the end of the story in terms of CP violation and the matter-antimatter symmetry? Once you've got the neutrino violation as a discovery, does that mean that we fully understand why there's more matter than antimatter in the universe, or is there more work to be done after that?
There are experiments which search for neutrino lesable beta decay, and these are able to test the violation of lepton number. Even if all these conditions are satisfied, these would give us circumstantial evidence that leptogenesis is at the origin of the baryon asymmetry of the universe. This is a process which, if happened, it did very, very, very early on in the universe at scales that we can never achieve, we can never test directly. So we will never be able to have a direct proof, but at least we will have some strong indications that we understand where the baryon asymmetry comes from.
You can read more about this important measurement by T2K in Neutrino Symmetry Violation Could Help Explain Why Matter Dominates Antimatter. And that's by Edwin Cartledge. And you can find the article on the Physics World website. Thanks for being on the Physics World Weekly podcast, Sylvia.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
That was Sylvia Pascoli of Durham University. I think it's safe to say that everyone interested in astronomy has a favorite image from the Hubble Space Telescope. Mine is a deep field image that is so packed with galaxies of different shapes and sizes that it looks like a cartoon version of space. The astronomy writer Keith Cooper has written a series of blogs for Physics World about his favorite Hubble images. Here he is in conversation with Margaret Harris about some highlights of the Hubble mission, how long it can keep operating, and what Hubble's ultimate fate will be.
So Keith, I mean, you've been following the sort of the career of the Hubble Space Telescope for a long time. I mean, do I dare ask if you remember its launch and sort of its impact on the astronomy community when it first went up there?
I do. I was 10 years old when it launched, and I remember it launching and all the hype about how amazing it was going to be, and then all of a sudden the huge disappointment. I was too young to understand exactly what had gone wrong with the telescope, but the huge disappointment that its optics were not able to focus as had been hoped. It had what's called spherical aberration, where basically different wavelengths of light can't come to focus at the same point. So the images looked blurry rather than, you know, the sharp images that they were hoping for. And it turned out that when they'd been building Hubble's mirror in the early 1980s, they'd ground it to the wrong curvature by just 2 microns, and that was just enough to affect its vision. And for a time, it just looked like it was going to be a big white elephant. And, you know, being 10 years old, I was so looking forward to seeing these amazing images that they'd promised, and it just wasn't quite as good as we hoped. So, you know, I guess if you'd asked astronomers back in 1990, few months after it had launched and that this problem had been discovered, that 30 years later Hubble would be at the forefront of all our amazing work that we do, you know, and all the different frontiers of astronomy, I suspect few of them would have believed that. So it's been a remarkable story.
And so that the way that was fixed, of course, is a huge part of that story, because there have been a number of, you know, really quite dramatic and expeditions, effectively, space missions to fix Hubble and to add new capabilities to it.
Yeah, I think some of the NASA people at the time actually said it was just fixing Hubble was as big a thing for NASA as landing on the moon or getting the crew of Apollo 13 home. It was that big a deal. There was a lot riding on it because of the huge expense of the telescope. I think it was $1.5 billion at the time. And, you know, it got a lot of bad press for NASA. It was a public relations nightmare for NASA. And then, you know, they figured out, well, this is just spherical aberration. We could easily fix that by effectively putting glasses on Hubble. So they built this instrument called COSTAR that they were able to install the astronauts when they launched in December 1993 to fix Hubble. They installed COSTAR, which was able to refocus the light so it could produce the images that everybody had hoped for, and they also added a couple of extra new cameras, the wide field and planetary camera too. And after that, you know, every image Hubble takes, it proves its worth. It's amazing, and it has had, as you mentioned, you know, further follow up missions with astronauts on board the space shuttle. I think there was a further 4, one in 1997, 1999, 2002, 2009, to fix instruments and to replace instruments with even more sophisticated cameras and spectrographs and things like that. So with the retirement of the shuttle fleet, obviously we haven't been able to do that. And this 11-year stretch since the final servicing mission has been the longest that Hubble has gone without, you know, having some kind of refurbishment, but it's still hanging in there. It's all its instruments are still working. Most of its gyroscopes are still working. So hopefully we can see at least another 10 years out of it.
And where would you say that Hubble sort of fits in the history of space telescopes as a whole? Because we now have, you know, several observatories, orbiting observatories, that are also looking at different wavelengths of the spectrum mainly.
Sure. And so Hubble focuses mostly on the optical and ultraviolet light. It can go a little bit into the near-infrared as well. Since the launch of Hubble, we've had gamma-ray telescopes like Fermi. We've had X-ray telescopes like Chandra. Spitzer Space Telescope was obviously infrared. The European Space Agency have launched space telescopes as well, such as Herschel. But I think where Hubble stands out is that it has a story. You know, it has this story of triumphing from the brink of disaster, basically. That whole story of how they went and fixed it. It was a dangerous mission for the astronauts. You had to do multiple spacewalks. It was quite risky for them. And the fact that they, you know, they turned this complete disaster into such a huge success, I think that has given Hubble a story, and you know, that people remember. You know, Hubble's a household name, and some of the observations that it made after that, it saw the impacts of the fragments of comet Shoemaker Levy 9 into Jupiter. It had a ringside seat for that. You know, it's taken the Hubble Deep Fields. It's measured the composition of exoplanet atmospheres. They're amazing pictures. You know, ultraviolet images or infrared images or X-ray images, you know, they're, for research purposes, they're, you know, they're vital, but in terms of aesthetic purposes, not, I don't think anything can really match what Hubble has achieved. So that combination of things has really, I think, you know, 100 years time, 200 years time, I think, you know, astronomical historians will still be talking about Hubble. It's just been an amazing mission, and long may it continue.
That's quite an interesting point you make about the legacy of it. That's really impressive. And you also mentioned that you know, the images we've got from Hubble. So you've been doing a series of blog posts for Physics World.
Yeah, my 10 favorite, or what I deem the most important images that Hubble has taken. And I think I commented in the commentary to some of those images. It is a little bit impossible to pick the definitive 10 images. And I imagine if somebody else did it, they'd come up with another 10. There's that many amazing images. But I've tried to get a good selection of different kinds of images. So there's planetary nebulae in there. There are gravitational lenses. There's you know, the most distant galaxies ever seen, globular clusters, some of the most massive stars in the galaxy, crashing galaxies into one another, amazing variety of images. And I think that's something else that really makes Hubble stand out is the variety of images. I mean, how often do we hear, you know, if something unusual or new has been discovered, you know, a supernovae or some other transient source, let's get Hubble to look at that. And Hubble has looked at everything from, you know, the planets in our own solar system to the most distant galaxies. It really does have a broad spectrum that it investigates. And the current telescopes that, are being built to be launched in the coming decade, they're not going to have quite the same range as Hubble. There's still no official replacement for Hubble yet. So there's the James Webb Space Telescope, which hopefully, fingers crossed, will finally launch next year, but that remains to be seen. There's still a lot of work to be done on finalizing that. But that will be the largest space telescope ever launched. It will have a segmented mirror, but with a total diameter of 6.5 meters, and Hubble's mirror is only 2.4 meters. So it's a lot larger, but it is designed to observe in the infrared, to be able to see, you know, the most distant galaxies whose light has been redshifted out of the optical regime, to be able to look into the atmospheres of exoplanets, to peer through the dust of nebulae to get a better understanding of how stars and planets form. But in terms of the images that it will produce, they won't look like the Hubble images. So it's not the all-rounder that Hubble has been. And I think that, you know, that's really made Hubble's name.
Because that's the important thing. In the blog post you made, these images, they all say something interesting about the nebula, the gravitational lenses, the deep field, this sort of thing. But they're also really beautiful, almost pieces of art. I think you're right that it's had a sort of a public outreach mission that's, you know, as big or even bigger, perhaps, in impact than its scientific mission.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, the NASA and European Space Agency staff at the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore have got to take a lot of the credit there for, you know, producing these images and processing them in you know, they call the Hubble palette, which is the color scheme that you use. So a lot of the Hubble images that you look at, as beautiful as they are, they're not always true life color. Sometimes it's exaggerated. Sometimes it's completely false color. But that, you know, I don't think that should detract from the beauty of what we're seeing. And you know, that every other picture it takes, you want to have on your wall as a poster. It's just incredible imagery of the universe. And before Hubble, you know, we really hadn't seen any images like that. I remember seeing the first time I saw the Pillars of Creation. Is on the cover of a magazine, I think, and I'd just never seen anything like that. These towering columns of molecular gas inside which stars were forming, and it was just beautiful, and it just shows what an amazingly beautiful universe we have to observe.
I think I had a similar reaction to the first time I saw what I now know to have been the Hubble Deep Field image, because, you know, I did some, you know, amateur astronomy when I was a teenager, and, you know, in my mind, you know, all the galaxies had names, or at least catalog numbers, all the interesting things to see that you point a telescope at in your backyard or a local observatory. And when I first saw the Hubble Deep Field image, it was given to me by an astronomer at Apache Point in New Mexico, which I was visiting on spring break, because I was a really nerdy kid. Mm-hmm. And I asked this astronomer, you know, what's the name of that galaxy? He says, oh, they haven't got names. They haven't even got numbers. There's too many of them. And I was just, that was just the mind-blowing moment, you know, for a teenager in the 1990s to see this for the first time.
That's exactly, you know, that feeling that you had. It's like a profound feeling. You know, when we see the pillars of creation, I mean, that's a profound image. That's stars being born and the process in which they are born. And the sun quite likely formed in something similar. You know, the deep fields, these are the oldest, most distant galaxies that we can see. This going back to close to the dawn of time, the Big Bang. I mean, can't get much more profound than that in terms of, you know, an image. You know, and it's that profoundness, I think, that really drives the wonder that we feel when we look at some of these images.
I think another image that's in your list is the image of the impact of the comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 on Jupiter. That's quite a different sort of image, because that's actually in our own backyard.
Yeah, and this was Hubble's first big test after it had been had its optics fixed. So this was about 6 months after that first servicing mission, and astronomers didn't really know what to expect. So for people who aren't familiar with what happened, was a comet was discovered by Jean Shoemaker and David Levy and Carolyn Shoemaker. It was the ninth comet they found, hence it was called Shoemaker-Levy 9. And what they discovered that was that it had gone close to Jupiter, and Jupiter's gravity had broken this comet apart into 21 fragments. It was like a string of pearls. And astronomers did calculations and realized it was going to come back around and hit Jupiter in the summer of 1994. So telescopes all across the world were trained on Jupiter. This whole process of impacting Jupiter lasted for about a week. Nobody knew what to expect. A lot of astronomers thought that the fragments would just enter Jupiter and disappear and there'd be nothing. And what happened, what Hubble saw, was these huge plumes of fire rising up out of the atmosphere and these dark bruises that the impacts all left on the surface of Jupiter. And it taught us a lot about, you know, the composition of Jupiter's atmosphere. The 1990s, I think, was a dawning time in terms of realizing the danger from asteroids and comets to life on Earth. And here we could see comets hitting a planet in our solar system and the titanic effects that had. So that raised a lot of eyebrows. But Hubble really came through on that, and it produced some amazing images. And that was Hubble's first big test, as I say, following its having its optics fixed. But as you're right, you know, that was in our solar system, just at Jupiter. So, you know, we've gone from, you know, observing Jupiter, Hubble can even observe Mars, to the furthest galaxies. It's quite extraordinary.
And final question, I think, you know, what do you think has the future hold for the Hubble Space Telescope? It's been up there for 30 years. As you said, it's had its last servicing mission 11 years ago. It's still going. What's going to happen to it? What will its fate be?
Unfortunately, it's probably not going to last forever. At the moment, it still has three gyroscopes working. The gyroscopes are really important because they are what allow Hubble to accurately point towards a target. It needs three at least to maintain optimum performance, but it can still point accurately with just two gyroscopes or even one gyroscope. So hopefully they'll last a few years yet. If they manage to last up into the 2030s, and if its cameras and other instruments are still functioning in the 2030s, which is possible, then NASA are faced with a little bit of a dilemma, because even though I think Hubble is something like 600 kilometers above the Earth, it still feels atmospheric drag. And by the mid-2030s, its orbit is going to start to decay, and if left to its own devices, it will come plummeting back into the atmosphere and burn up. Which could be dangerous if it burns up over a populated area. So in the final servicing mission, they strapped on something that would allow a rocket to attach to Hubble. and either guide it into a controlled descent, where it would burn up over, say, the Pacific Ocean, or maybe take it up to a higher orbit. But without the space shuttle to take astronauts to the telescope and to fix it, then there's not a lot that can be done beyond that point if everything breaks down. So eventually it will come to an end, which will seem really strange because, you know, Hubble has been essential to everything that, you know, astronomers have been doing over the last 20, 30 years, you know, everything from dark energy, dark matter, you know, studying the formation of stars, planets, the evolution of galaxies, as I said. So it's going to be really strange to not have Hubble with us. And as I mentioned, there's no direct replacement for it yet. JWST, James Webb Space Telescope, will be in the infrared. They're building another space telescope called the Wide Field Infrared Survey Telescope. And as the name suggests, that is also going to be in the infrared. There's a slightly interesting story behind that telescope. About 10 years ago, the NASA administrator, Charlie Bolden, got a phone call from somebody at the National Reconnaissance Office, and they'd been building spy satellites that had these big 2.4-meter mirror telescopes, mirrors. But they decided not to use them. So they said, hey, do you want to use these for some NASA telescope? He said, yeah, we'll definitely use them. And that's what became WFIRST. But that's going to be an infrared survey telescope. It has a wide field of view rather than the smaller, more focused field of view that Hubble has. So again, that's not going to be a direct replacement. There is one on the drawing board. It's called LUVOIR. That stands for the Large Ultraviolet Optical Infrared Telescope. And it's currently one of four space missions that NASA are considering for a flagship mission for the 2030s. And there's two options, one for an 8-meter telescope and the other is for a 15-meter telescope, which would be huge. And if it did get selected, it would launch around 2039. And, for example, it would have the resolution able to image planets as close to stars as Earth and Venus are to our sun, which would be a huge breakthrough. It would be able to resolve, though, on the Hubble Deep Field, all those galaxies that you referred to that didn't even have names, these little blobs, it would be able to resolve those into, you know, proper galaxies. You'd be able to see the spiral arms or the star clusters and things like that. So it would be amazing if that could launch. And that would be the direct replacement for Hubble. Of course, there's ground-based telescopes, things like the Extremely Large Telescope and the 30-meter telescope that will also operate in the optical regime, but they have to cope with the Earth's atmosphere and its distorting effects. But yeah, so hopefully Hubble will continue at least until the mid-2030s and that there will be, you know, a telescope like LUVOIR ready to come and replace it. But it will be strange with not have Hubble. It's just been so quintessential to astronomy for the last three decades. And hopefully it'll be around for at least another 15 years.
Hopefully so. Well, happy birthday to Hubble, and here's hoping for many more. Keith Cooper, thanks very much.
Thank you.
That was Keith Cooper talking to Physics World's Margaret Harris about the Hubble Space Telescope. And you can find Keith's blogs on the Physics World website. That's all the time we have for this week's podcast. Thanks to Sylvia Piscoli, Keith Cooper, and Margaret Harris for joining me today. And a special thanks to our producer, Callum Jelf. If you like what you've heard this week, you can subscribe to the Physics World Weekly podcast via Apple Podcasts or another podcast app of your choice. Or you can follow us on Spotify. Thanks for listening, and please do join us again next week. Physics World.